Hi, welcome to the China Unscripted Podcast. I'm Chris Chappell.
And I'm Matt Ganeshta.
Wait, where's Shelley?
Shelley is in Canada.
Ugh, why Canada?
She had something to take care of there with family.
Oh, assassination?
I don't know.
Okay, cool. Well, just a reminder, leave us some good reviews on iTunes and some 5 stars. And joining us today, we do have a special guest to replace Shelley, and that's Alan.
Hey guys, how you doing? It's good to be here.
Alan, you may know as our camera guy who went with us on several trips to Hong Kong and Taiwan and the Philippines and the South China Sea. So thanks for joining us today, Alan.
Yeah, thanks for having us,
The royal us.
The royal us, yes.
Alan is somewhat schizophrenic. It actually is kind of awkward because we have to pay each of the personalities.
Well, that's how you double dip, you know.
Yeah.
The economy's pretty rough right now.
Yeah, it's the insane that make out the best. As you can say with so many things. So besides being our occasional camera guy, what do you do? Tell the folks.
So right now, I run a small video production company. I say that to people, but it's really, we do a bunch of YouTube channels. So a few of the channels we do, one is called Generation Tech. There's another one called Generation Films that covers more like sci-fi films, Star Wars. And then we have another side which does more like finance, business stuff. That's Credit Sifu and Business Sifu. So with that, I got my my hands full, really. No more video production work for me for the time being, unfortunately.
Is this how you're telling us you're not going to work with us again?
No, you see, that's the thing. I'll work with you guys because, whenever I work with you guys, we end up going on crazy adventures.
Lots of danger.
And, that is the one thing in my life that I don't have enough, I think. I need more adventure.
Well, I just saw your video on Credit Sifu, which was you going to Thailand for $1,000, including airfare.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I hope the IRS isn't listening, but that was just an attempt to...
The IRS is our biggest fans.
Well, I mean, I didn't do this. I mean, nothing I'm saying right now is on the record, but yeah, it was an attempt to just, have some business expenses I can write off.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Matt, legally speaking, is doing a podcast. Is that on the record?
Oh, yeah, this is completely on the record. Yeah, well, you're not going to edit that out.
You guys don't know I'm here. Like, you can't prove that I'm here.
You're in front of us right now.
Yeah, but there's no video, man. I could be just a random guy,
an AI compiled.
Just a random guy with a beard off the street.
This is a deep fake right now.
Well, look, they're having a what news organization? I read an article recently where they plugged the AI guy in and they started writing.
Oh, China's Xinhua News?
Maybe it was no, it wasn't a Chinese publication. I'm sure China's also doing this, but it was some American publication where they basically just fed him a bunch of the AI. I'm saying him already.
Uh-huh.
But they fed the AI some headlines, and, it's just started recreating stories on its own. I'm like, oh, wow, I thought
creative. What do you mean by recreating? You mean making up news?
Like making up news, yeah, exactly.
Like regular CNN journalists.
You know the one thing? You guys remember that trip we had to – I forget if it was our first trip to Hong Kong or our second one, and we were talking to one of the local CNN guys, and I remember specifically when he was referring to American CNN, he said domestic, like to distance himself. Do you remember that?
No, I remember him talking about. I don't want to name his name.
We shouldn't name him, but I found that very interesting.
Yeah, actually, and I know I'm making a joke about CNN earlier, but that's the punchline. But there are a lot of good journalists at CNN that I've met.
No, sure, definitely.
And a lot of the individual journalists do try very hard to have good and accurate stories, just so I am clear
I mean, I love... I still watch CNN a lot. I'm on the fence about it because I love how everything has kind of just gone everywhere, on YouTube, on the internet.
Wait, you love that?
I like that because you have, it's like the democratization of content.
Oh, you mean
so
there's more voices.
Yeah, but I also having worked in the media with you guys for a little bit, I understand there's a lot of pressure right now, financial pressure. That's one of the reasons why I left being a camera guy. It was I did my last freelance job last year. I started turning things down because I was look, man, automation is going to come for my job. You guys are just going to have drones flying around. They're going to continue cutting costs. So, I'm worried about traditional media disappearing because that's an avenue for trained journalists to go to.
That's an
individuals,
interesting point.
I mean, who have a training, they have a degree usually. And, there's a there's a type of journalism that I think is missing sometimes from the internet.
Oh, you know? Walter Cronkite kind of?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, we definitely demonize journalists a lot, and they've done a lot of damage, I think, especially in the last few months. You had the Covington kids, right?
That
was kind of scary, you know? Like, you had people coming out and doxing people.
Big-name people.
I mean, the good thing was, I think, a lot of journalists came out and apologized, and they're like, okay, you know, like, we got to take a step back.
Maybe we shouldn't have said, let's all kill that kid.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, like, a good sign. And then you obviously have...
Is that a good sign, or is that just, like, basic, like...
Well, no, it's a step back from the edge, and I think it's good that a lot of journalists recorrected themselves. Because, I think Matt's right. These are not bad people. A lot of them are professional. Like, you know, I've been in press pools and stuff. Like, they're usually... good intentioned people, you know, but I think there's a lot of pressure to just get the story
out.
Get the story out quick enough and sensationalize, right?
Yeah. I mean, because everyone's struggling to make money.
Yeah, and it's a good point about editors too. So there's a journalist from one of the mainstream media, and again, I don't want to name this, but I was having a conversation with her over dinner last year, and this reporter said to me that for all their regular stories, you know, they have an editor.
Mm-hmm.
But for any story that is China related, even if it's written in some other country, those stories have an additional layer of editorial. It has to go through their Beijing bureau to make sure it's not politically sensitive. And that's because that media is, like all the Western media that have a bureau in China, they're at risk of getting their bureau kicked out or at risk of getting their website blocked in China or whatever,
right.
And they fear those sort of unknown consequences of the Chinese Communist Party's influence, and so they just have to be super careful with that stuff. And it's a frustration to at least this one reporter.
Sure.
And I imagine to a lot of good reporters.
Well, the idea is, are you a rebel? Are you going to just say, screw you guys, I'm going to do what I want, and you get kicked out? Or do you kind of remain in the system and still, you know, sometimes are able to report on things, you know, from a more clear point of view? You know, what if something like Tiananmen Square happens again?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Then
but it depends on your media. Yeah. Like I would say someone like Megha Rajagopalan, who worked for BuzzFeed and did a lot of excellent reporting on Xinjiang and the persecution of Uyghurs there.
Sure.
Like, she pushed the envelope. BuzzFeed let her, and then she got essentially kicked out of China by having her visa not renewed, which is the typical nice way they kick people out.
Yeah.
And her media basically supported her, but only, of course, up until the point when they're like, all right, well, if you're kicked out of China, we have to just move you to some other country. But I think that had she been working for... say the New York Times or NBC, I think those editors might have said, don't go to Xinjiang at all,
mm-hmm.
because we know what's going to happen to you and to us.
Well, I mean, there have been a lot of on the scene reporting from like Reuters and I know a couple others. So
is that through stringers or are they sending their own?
You
team?
Know, I don't know how okay. they make it. And that's
I feel like locals would be, you know, easier, right? I
mean, yeah. It's a lot of times when you're a foreign correspondent, like you hire local stringers to help you and you lead the reporting. What the challenge is there is that in China, a lot of times, even if like the worst that can happen to, say, me as a white American reporting in China is I get my visa forcibly not renewed or expired.
Okay.
And I have to leave. But the stringers that I've hired could actually be arrested.
Right, right.
And or their family members threatened and so on. And so that's a lot of times why, like, you need the stringers, but then you don't want to put people at risk. And this is one of the reasons why, like, you know, Chris, you and Shelley and I have talked before about hiring people in China to shoot some footage, but always it comes back to the risk is how much do you want to put people in danger to get the story?
Mm-hmm.
And for us, typically, that's not. Like, we don't want to do that to people. But it's a difficult balance, and there's no easy solution to that. And I think that, you know, yeah, the New York Times does sometimes have good reports and on China, but a lot of times what you don't know about it is what the reporter learned that never made it into the article
mm.
because the reporter knew it would be censored, or the editor cut it out, or the higher ups above the regular editor said, don't include this part. And so you probably won't get outright criticism of the Chinese Communist Party. It might just be a, here are some facts on the ground, and here's what the authorities say in their response, and so on.
Why don't they just leak it to someone like you guys who have no chance of going into China anyway?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Secret, do some secret stuff, you know? Put it on a flash drive,
well,
sneak it out
any,
of the country.
Any reporter who's stationed in China, and if you would like to leak stories to us, send us an email at chinaunscripted@gmail.com. We are here for you.
Now you're going to get a lot of crazy mail from the Chinese government, so good job with that.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Don't click on anything for like a few weeks.
Yeah, well, a lot of the problems with like anonymous leaks that you see in the media, and like I'm all for anonymous reporting being allowed, but when you do that, you have like a real responsibility.
And, to make sure that that's based on something.
Right, because like a lot of times, like in the Judith Miller case about chemical weapons in Iraq, like she had this source that she protected and fed her this information, and it turned out that it was Scooter Libby who was worked with Dick Cheney. And the leak that she thought was this breaking news that she had the exclusive on was actually an intentional leak meant to push a very specific political agenda.
That, and of course, were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Right, which turned out to they never found the chemical and biological weapons that that she had mentioned or the weapons of mass destruction. And of course, none of this came out until much later.
Yeah.
But so that's an example, obviously, of anonymous reporting.
Gone wrong.
But that's not to say that anonymous reporting is bad per se. It's just, I think that reporters have to be super careful. They have to really think about the nature of the leak. I mean, look at the Watergate scandal. There, they had a deep background anonymous source who was a legitimate leak who didn't actually provide them information, though, just basically told them when they were on the right track or off the right track.
Right.
And told them to follow the money. I mean, we've all seen All the President's Men, so we kind of know how that goes. I'm too young to be alive during the Watergate scandal, but...
Yeah. But, I mean, you see that today, too, like, because politicians know how to use media to their own advantage. And so, you know, today, especially since the Trump presidency started, you see a lot of anonymous officials told us that... And, like, when that's what every single story is being based on, it gets to be a little dicey.
I mean, he's brilliant with how he's kind of maneuvering himself. Like, I mean, it's the thing that I have problems with is, like a lot of people are like, oh, like, he's planned everything. So, like, that's what I kind of wonder. Like,
oh, like, people think that, like, Trump is doing the leaks or something?
No, I'm saying, like, how he kind of, like, from one viewpoint, you might say he's baiting the media, actually, to direct the course of the discussion in the country, you know? Like, I think some people, people think it's all very, like, planned, and he, like, you know, when he tweets something and suddenly he's dominating the news line, headlines, like he's doing it purposely, right? Like, or is it just him saying things off the cuff because that's who he is? So, like, I find that very interesting because, you know, he's a guy who comes from television, right? Like, while everyone else ran a political campaign, he basically he created a persona, you know?
He ran a trailer for his show, which was the presidency.
I mean, do you think he maybe, like, created a character and then tried to test it in front of, like, sample audiences? I mean, is it that far to say that? Who knows? You know?
I just,
like,
wanted to remind everyone listening that Alan's opinions are his own, and we do not necessarily endorse them.
Like, I know. I'm a little loose with Trump. Like, but, you know, he's such an interesting person. Like, I don't think we've ever
That's
seen
true.
A president like him before. And, you know, he's really a president for the age we're living in right now, which is, like, kind of just insane. Everything is about social media. Everything is about the, like, you know, 24-hour news cycle. It's just like, bam, 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 you know.
That's absolutely true.
And those of us in the media on all sides of the, you know, political spectrum are grateful that there's such an interesting president.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. I mean, to the degree that we're all just money hungry and want news no matter whether it's important or not important, that there is news provided for us.
We can make our own news.
Yeah. We could just make stuff up.
Which we don't do, right?
Right. I'm not saying we make stuff up.
All right. It's come out. There's no such country as China. I'm sorry. It's all...
Well, talk about that. You guys hear about the new... It's a new conspiracy theory. It goes beyond the flat earth and... what was the other one? The mountains are actually trees.
Okay.
So there's one now that space isn't real.
Really?
Which is the flat earthers are laughing at these guys. So
I feel like a lot of this is started by trolls, right? I mean, it's not actually
possibly.
Real stuff.
But then sometimes you find somebody who really believes it. So space, there's no such thing as space.
There's no such thing as space.
So what's, are we living in a dome? Like, what was that movie?
Oh, I didn't get that far, but yeah. What, Biodome?
Bali Shore.
Oh, no, you're thinking about the Truman Show.
Yeah,
right?
It's the Truman Show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, we're all in
the
Truman Show.
But I forgot about Biodome. Oh, man, Pauly Shore.
Yeah, what
it's
happened?
It's totally happening, buddy. Oh, man.
Yeah. The 90s were horrible.
Yeah. They were. Now, I was thinking about the Truman Show, and that in his case, space was not real.
Space was not real?
Well, no, the space was real. Like, eventually, he would reach outer space.
Right. So how does the... How does this, the no spacers, shall we call them?
I know, I just don't know, man. I heard this in passing. I was like, oh, this is cool.
So you're possibly just passing on fake news.
It could be fake news about fake conspiracies.
That could be.
They're redirecting us from other things.
Well, I heard there was, for a while, like a fake, like a troll thing where they were saying, like, flat earthers believe Australia doesn't exist.
Oh, okay.
And everyone you have met who says they're from Australia is actually a government agent. But apparently that was fake. Like, that's not something flat earth.
I hope that's true, because I used to live in Australia, and if that whole thing was a lie that I believed...
It was drugs injected into you by the government, Matt, the whole thing. You sit on a plane, the gas comes out, you go to sleep, you wake up with a whole bunch of memories, a little less blood and maybe an organ or two less. And
that definitely seems like a more realistic thing than me actually living in Australia.
Why?
I mean, it could have been Arizona. I was being sarcastic, but maybe I should explain sarcasm to you.
I didn't pick it up. Well, I mean, one thing I want to bring up, though, is, like, you know, Alan, a lot of people don't know this about you, but you're a real humanitarian.
Oh,
yeah. You started an important movement called Humanity First.
So this is on Generation Tech, and, man, I've never really talked about this, like, outside of my persona on the show. Which is like the xenophobic, like I hate dolphins,
which
you
I
know,
get.
I hate, like, you know, machines. Basically, my whole what I realized was, like, you know, YouTube, man, you guys read the comments. It's just like a really toxic wasteland, right? I mean,
I love our fans.
I mean, I love our fans too, but, like, sometimes you go through the comments and, like, if you read too many, man, you just become depressed. You're like, oh God, is this the world we're living in right now? Like, there's way too many Nazis, you know, there's way too many crazies, you know, just saying terrible things in the comments. And, you know, so one of the things was like, well, you know, like, where does this anger come from? Where does this, all this, like, emotion, negative emotion come from? And, like, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with, there's something fundamentally wrong in our, wrong going on in our country. And I think it all goes to economic things.
Mm-hmm.
I think automation has played a huge role in really just, like, taking out huge swaths of jobs in the Midwest. Like, you know, people talk about automation like, oh, it's going to come in, like, 20, 30 years. I think it's already here. Like, I saw it in my job as a camera guy. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's a job called being you can be a steady cam operator, right?
Yeah.
This is a really physically grueling job. You had to go train yourself for, like, 2-3 years. Buy tens of thousands of dollars of equipment. Now you have these electric gimbals, which basically motorize the whole process, and now you don't need any training or anything. Mm-hmm. You just come off the street and do it. And, yeah, like, technology has really, I think, eliminated a lot of jobs in the middle of the country. And on top of that, there's the Great Recession, you know, that really affected my generation. I know a lot of my friends growing up, they don't have jobs. They're still at home, and, you know, they're kind of in a lot of pain right now because of that. And I feel like, I mean, you know, this is all theories, but I feel like a lot of stuff I see on YouTube, because I know my demographic. The people who watch my show are basically me, you know, in 20s to 30s, male, like 95% men.
That's
like
you?
Women just find me, they don't like me.
Really?
But so I was like, well, I understand where all this anger and hate is. Like, you know, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in the media right now. Like, everyone is basically attacking each other. You know, there's, like, a lot of, you know, identity stuff going on. And I'm like, well, you know, like, I understand where all this hate is. So let's take this hate and let's kind of redirect it at something.
Channel into something useful.
Yeah, something useful. Like, you know, like,
so go after the Dolphins.
Go after – I mean, Dolphins are –
I mean, look, we're all jealous of their superior intellect.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're the second most intelligent, right? I think they
– I thought octopi.
Octopi.
Octopi were very smart.
It's not octopuses.
Octopussy.
Octopussy.
That was a James Bond movie.
No, that was a James Bond character.
Character, right.
In a James Bond movie.
Yeah. So yeah, the idea is like, hey, let's play up the mm-hmm. thing that, you know, let's play up the humanity first thing. Let's play up this whole idea that we're all humans, you know, like, you know, we should be watching out for each other. We shouldn't be fighting each other. But at the same time, I recognize, like, the anger. Like, I see what's going on in the news every day, and it does scare me, and it makes me worry. And I'm like, well, if we're going to redirect this anger at something, let's redirect it now at aliens. I mm-hmm. mean, hopefully they don't come, because if they do come, they're probably going to target me, and that'll
you
be very bad.
A very
but
bad move.
I'm just kind of betting. I'm just kind of gambling on the fact that they won't come in my lifetime, hopefully. Mm-hmm.
They're already here, Alan.
Well, actually, I read this article that this is an interesting theory that, like, the reason we haven't seen aliens yet is we're actually the most advanced species in our quadrant of the galaxy.
Oh.
So, good news, that means we'll probably develop spaceflight before any other sentient beings in the nearby area.
So and we will be the aliens.
We will be the conquering, which to me is okay for now. Like, when we meet aliens, if that ever happens, then we'll deal with, you know, like how we treat them and everything like that. For now, let's try to fix the problems here on Earth. But so anyway, so it's kind of like it's a little of a gag joke. You know, I you know, this is to anyone from Generation Tech or films listening. Like, I don't want you guys to go out there and kill dolphins. Please don't do that.
What about aliens?
Don't kill aliens either. But, like, you know, like, it's more, I want people to focus more on the humanity first part. Yeah. And that's really the important part.
In some ways, it's like a very pure form of racism.
Yeah, no, it is a xenophobic, like, hate group, really. And it's just bizarre because, I mean, you know me. Like, I love trolling people. I love just finding interesting ways of, you know, messing with people. And this is just like kind of a positive way. I mean, but yeah. So the interesting thing is, like, a week ago, I was watching the Joe Rogan podcast, and this guy came on. His name is Andrew Yang, right? He's like a 44-year-old Taiwanese American, and he's running for Democrat. He's going to be running in the Democrat primary. I think he declared, like, last year or something like that. And he's running on a universal base income.
But he stole your slogan.
Well, that's the thing. So I was like, okay, this guy's interesting. Like, I've heard a lot of conservative pundits actually talk about UBI, which is kind of where I'm like, oh, okay, that's kind of interesting. That's not something you would hear a conservative really saying, like, basically wealth redistribution, right? I mean, that's kind of what the UBI is, at least from my basic understanding. So I looked into this guy a little more because he's really interesting. He was talking about a lot of issues that I kind of felt like was affecting a lot of automation problems, a lot of job loss issues. So I looked at his website, and yeah, there it is right there in the center, humanity first. I'm like, whoa.
But it's not a reference to your thing?
I don't think so.
You don't think he watched Generation Tech and then took your slogan?
I doubt it. I think humanity first is something that is just like an obvious thing, isn't it? That's like the development. Like, that's the time we're living in. Like, there's this interesting thing I like to talk about all the time. It's there's somewhere around like 400-500 humans who have left Earth. Since we've developed the fake space program.
You mean like permanently?
No, like they've gone into space.
They've gone like past the stratosphere or whatever, like inner space.
The most important part is they viewed Earth from space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most people go into space when they come back, they get medical checkups, right? And a lot of them actually talk to psychologists. And what these psychologists started noticing was that their worldview started changing. It's something they call the overview effect. And it's like a cognitive shift where they begin seeing the domestic and international issues we have here on Earth as less important and kind of almost silly because, like, you know, these are people going up there and they're viewing Earth as just one organism, you know, one little sphere just protected by a thin layer of ozone, right?
Yeah.
Unless it's a flat disc, and I don't know what that would be.
Well, I mean, all these people are liars.
They're all liars, and but
there's no such thing as space.
No, but the thing is, these people, they go up there and they see it, and, like, yeah, they start realizing, like, wow, you know, we have bigger things to worry about, you know, than
Just like the aliens.
Like the aliens. Now, like, what if an asteroid hits us? I don't know. I mean, the thing is, they become, I think, a less emotionally attached to international politics, domestic politics. They start, and I think once you become less emotional about these things, you become less tribal. I mean, you're able to, you know, rationalize how you view certain situations. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what ends up being, like, the best way of participating in a democracy, right?
Well, unless you become super tribal and just the tribe is humanity.
Right, okay.
Against everything else in the universe.
Yeah, I can see the flaw in humanity first.
Well, no, I agree with this.
Without an enemy, like, it will fall apart.
So this is beautiful. I think this is a beautiful form of racism.
Yeah,
I think
it's not racism.
It is the human race.
Well, I tell people this. I'm like, well, first of all, I'm... This might be a little controversial, but I don't really see I don't see you and me as different races. I think we're the human race.
Yeah.
So like I don't understand this. Oh, you're Asian, you're black, you're white. I mean, I know a lot of people say that, like a lot of racist people kind of say this in order to just not make it an issue that we discuss. But I really think that, like, if you look at it scientifically, like, you know, our DNA variances are very small, like minimal. You know, like, so. You know.
I mean, my eyes are open. Like, I always considered myself not to be a racist because I felt like that.
Right.
But I realized, really, I am just an extreme racist.
No, well, I mean, what we like
my
to say...
My race is the best race in the universe.
Well, what
the
I like,
human race.
What I like to say for humanity first is we're speciesists. We're not racist.
I think either can be used. I mean, like, it's not that I hate aliens. I don't want to live with them.
Yeah.
They should be, you know,
you haven't met them
neighborhoods
yet,
and planets.
You haven't met them
You
yet.
Know, I'm sure there's a few good ones.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
We're not talking about immigrants, are we?
Illegal aliens.
Oh, okay. Okay, Jesus Christ, man. So a buddy of mine, the guy I work with on one of our Channel Generation films, his name is Ben, not the Ben you guys know.
Okay.
We have two Bens. We have a British Ben, which is Brent Hedges. Mm-hmm. He's never been on China Uncensored, has he?
I don't know.
He did the voiceover for... The lifestyles of the rich and corrupt, or whatever.
If you recognize that, you're a true fan.
Yeah, that's
remember.
I'm not even sure I'm getting the name. If you're a true fan, you'll know what the actual name of that segment was.
Rousing the Rich and Corrupt.
Yeah, it was something like that. We just needed a British voice, and Ben.
He doesn't have a very British accent anymore.
Yeah, but we asked him to play it up a bit.
Well, no, I asked him. I pointed at the rear end of the car the other day. I'm like, "What is that?" And he goes, "It's a trunk." I'm like, "No, man, it's a boot. It's a boot." Boot? No, that's Canadian.
A boot. It is a boot.
Right. Anyway, so yeah, he's not. But we have him. We call him British Ben because we have another Ben. He's called American Ben. And American Ben has really, he's really bought into the Humanity First thing, and he's talking about writing a manifesto. And like now I'm a little
only
worried.
Only the best things have manifestos.
Yeah, because now I'm a little worried because, like, all right, well, you know, like, I don't want anyone like committing acts of violence in the name of this movement, you know, because
I mean,
like,
that's what you've started.
I mean, like, it's populist forever. That's what I'm kind of digging into. And it's fun. It's fun until it gets too serious. But
we find another alien race and then suddenly it's.
But I mean, I love our core generation tech fans. They're like really cool people. They're like really nice, you know, rational people. So I think they're all in on the joke, more or less. Mm. Maybe there's like one or two dudes who, you know, her swimming around, you know, with spears trying to kill dolphins. But, you know, I'm going to disassociate myself from that. Yeah.
I mean, because it's not a very efficient way to kill dolphins is the main issue.
What, you saying like dynamite or something?
No,
or,
slowly
or,
poisoning the oceans with pollution.
Oh, with plastic. Just buy more plastic bags.
Yeah, just buy like tuna fish, you know. I mean, it's easy.
Unsafe tuna.
Right.
I don't think you can even get that anymore.
I'm sure you
dolphin.
I don't think they market it as that. It's just the cheaper
tuna. 39 cents a can.
Like anti-dolphin.
Taste the dolphin. Well, dolphins rape people, don't they?
They rape other dolphins, though.
I mean, there is
that
too. Well, there's actually a case that, you know, like, I think it's because of their high intelligence. They are kind of one of the more messed up creatures in the ocean and on land. I mean, they do rape. Yeah. I mean, like, the male dolphin sometimes will gang rape female dolphins.
That's not cool.
And I'm not generalizing, guys. I'm not saying all dolphins do this. I'm just talking about individuals who have happened to have done this.
Hashtag not all dolphins.
Yeah, hashtag not all dolphins, right. Yeah.
Well, that's terrifying. So,
yeah, so stay out of the water, man. Like, we are land animals, and I think we do better on land. Yeah.
You know, I think Jaws was funded by a dolphin to get people to focus on the wrong thing.
Yeah. Well, hey, look, give the Dolphins a million years, man. If they can adapt.
I'm not going to give them a million years.
Well, give them a million years. They'll start taking over the underground. I mean, we're pouring a lot of crazy stuff in the water. Maybe that'll speed up the evolution, you know?
From what I've seen from movies and comic books, exposure to radiation.
No, yeah. I mean, we're training dolphins.
They'll become mutant ninjas, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of exposure to radiation, one of my favorite memories of us working together was on a flight to... This is you'll recognize where this is going. We were on a flight to Hong Kong, and we watched Terraformars.
Oh, okay.
Man, that movie.
I was like, did you take me on a job and not tell me about like radiation danger, dude? Like,
well, I mean, that trip in the South China Sea, you know.
Well, they say airplanes, you do get exposed to some bad radiation up there.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
I actually think the South China Sea trip was like the... I felt so clean in a lot of ways.
I had a cough for like 2 weeks, and then after spending 3 days with you guys, my lungs were just cleared up.
Because it was like 3 full days essentially on a fishing boat,
right?
And like the air was clean. Like we didn't even like you couldn't even really read because it was like up and down. You just kind of like sit there and like talk and like look at the ocean.
We were a bunch of landlubbers.
Well, the interesting thing is,
but it was just very relaxing.
Yeah, I mean, I get terrible motion sickness. And Shelly threw up first. I threw up second.
Yeah.
But after I threw up, by the second or third day, dude, I was like, I had my sea legs. I was reading a book. Like, on a
rocking
boat.
I saw you doing some editing.
Yeah, I was editing. I'm like, wow, so sea legs is a thing. Like, you get them pretty quickly. Yeah.
So if you don't know what we're talking about, this was back in 2016 when China and the Philippines were really having a heated territorial dispute over the Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea. So we went to the Philippines and hired a Filipino fisherman to take us on his boat to this disputed territory. And
he thought we were a little nuts. Why would you want to go there?
Where there's the Chinese Coast Guard.
Yeah.
And they have attacked Filipino fishermen previously.
But yeah, so that was...
That was a cool time.
That was a great trip.
That is not something you typically do on a normal vacation.
I also like that we actually got out and stood on the Scarborough Shoal when the water was about waist deep.
It was a little disappointing. I thought it would be bigger, you know?
The Scarborough Shoal?
Yeah. Well, the shoal was big. Yeah. It was just that it was all like a couple feet underwater because it was high tide.
Yeah.
Well, it also looked like the reef was dead. And like there are reports of China like poisoning reefs so they can eventually build on it.
Why can't you just build on a living reef? You're just going to put sand on it.
You'll have air pockets.
Oh, I see.
Probably. I don't know. So,
that sounded good.
Yeah, no, that's just nonsense. I mean, I really buy into that it's not about what you say, it's how you say it.
The confidence.
Kind of
like how if you walk into a place in a suit, you can do anything.
I thought you were going to go with the bank robbing scenario for some reason. I thought walk into a bank.
It's like that movie, The Old Man and the Gun. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Oh, nope. Robert Redford.
Yeah. And I saw that with my dad.
Okay.
Because like Robert Redford and my dad are like the same age. I thought he'd like to see it.
Yeah.
He's just like, he basically wears a nice suit, very charming, wears a hat in the traditional hat, you know, and just goes into a bank, is very polite to the teller and says, you know, I've got a gun. Please put your money in here. And he gives the teller a big smile and they do what he says and he walks out, you know, and it's just like, whoa, you can get away with so much.
Someone's going to copycat that.
I mean, it's an old movie, so if it was going to happen, it would have.
Oh, it was a they redid a movie.
It was a movie based on a true story, a real person who robbed a number of banks. I guess it was like the 70s or something. It was before all the security measures were put in place.
Sure,
where it was easier to rob a bank.
It was very easy. Nowadays, robbing a bank, typically you only get a few thousand in cash,
right?
And you'll be caught almost immediately because the amount of surveillance is very high.
Yeah.
The vaults are often on 15-minute timers. So if you ever try to get into a vault in the bank, they're like, oh, sorry, like you've got to wait for 15 minutes and you just have to sit there.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're all programmed like that, so there's no way a teller could actually do it under
duress.
That's
why the guys in Point Break were smart.
Well, shouldn't you just hack nowadays? Isn't that the best way? Just like hack
there's
money?
A variety of better ways to make money.
There's so many.
I mean, we live in the surveillance state now. I mean, not really, but like if you go into any major city in the United States right now, like if you commit a crime in a downtown area, you're kind of and especially in the street, you're just an idiot.
That's why there's no CSI in New York, because like people just get caught immediately.
Yeah, it's not as interesting. Well, like you know Jesse Smollett thing.
It's like
they were able to like retrack their entire thing. Like there was like a 30-minute gap where he wasn't on the camera, but that's like crazy. You know, you didn't have that like you didn't have that like even 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, maybe 10 years ago. Sort of tip of the spear for surveillance is, and we should talk about this because this is actually the China Unscripted podcast. is in first-tier Chinese cities, Beijing and Shanghai. The amount of surveillance is insane, and they have, you know, about 200 million surveillance cameras across the country now. But what they want is, what was it, like 3 billion by 2030? What was the statistic? Yeah,
basically 2 cameras per person in China.
Yeah. Wow, so it's like, instead of guns, they're going with the cameras thing. Like, because in America, it's like 3 gun, oh no, 1 gun per person. So.
It's not, I forget exactly what the statistic, I think it's like 1 per 17.
So this is what China, this is why China is building an AI, because they're going to have crazy amounts of data to sort through.
Well, yes, right. That is
so,
a big part.
So they have like, you know, SenseNets, what is that?
No, that was a company Skynet. We talked about. Skynet. Xinjiang. Well, they do have Skynet.
SenseFace, I think, is the name of one
it's
of
called,
their...
Oh, yeah, SenseFace. It's called, yeah.
They have really, like, awkward names sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, this probably sounds better in Chinese,
SenseFace,
right?
It can't possibly sound worse. It's basically software, yeah, that'll sort through terabytes of data and figure out what are the faces and then match up the faces. And
it's facial recognition technology.
You can track the movements of any individual throughout the entire course of a day, no matter where they go in a city like Chongqing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like they're tracked the whole time. And if you set the AI up to track a person in real time, it'll do it. Or you can go back through history and track where they were on, you know, April 2nd, 2018. Once the cameras are there, it's good.
Yeah, and that reminds me of what we recently heard in Xinjiang, where another company called SenseNets.
Also a great name.
Why, which was Sense? Why Sense? Like sensory?
I think they were like fans of the Sixth Sense.
I think their naming scheme just lacks common sense.
I don't even want to share the story anymore.
They also have the social score now, right? Whereas, like, if you've committed a crime or you have bad credit, you can't even go into the central tiers or, like, use public transport, right?
It's a little more complicated than that, because it's not like there's a single program. It was, like, kind of a vague government directive, and then a bunch of different companies, some state-backed, some private, tried to create their own version of what a social credit system would look like. So it's not quite as, like, it is not the, like, crazy 1984 surveillance thing that it's often described as in the West.
Okay.
Because China already has that crazy 1984 surveillance system anyways. This is just, like, another thing that's already tapping into the pre-existing surveillance system.
Yeah, but there is, I actually read an article in the National Post called, it says, China's Orwellian social credit system blocked 17.5 million people from buying airline tickets last year. And
were they all Uyghurs? Probably a lot of Uyghurs.
Well, it's just like anyone who has a social credit problem, but they can just blacklist your name from buying airline tickets. And like, granted, you could say, oh, well, America does it too. We have a no fly list. And that's true, but
it's different how you get on that list.
Right. Yeah. Like, you're suspected of being a terrorist. In China, it's your suspected of being like either against the Communist Party or having like a low quality credit, like financial credit, or just like a whole variety of things, or it could be even your family and friends potentially.
Or in the case of the Uyghurs, they'll just say you're terrorists.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. Didn't the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia just go visit Beijing, right, recently?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I haven't heard that.
Yeah, I think I read about it. And I just wonder, like, what, you know, they're obviously doing terrible things to Muslims out there, right? They're re-educating them, like, you know, forcing. Is it true they're forcing them to eat bacon? Because that's just, like, some messed up.
I have heard that.
Like, there are reports being forced to eat pork and drink alcohol, which are both forbidden by halal tradition. But I'm not sure how widespread it is or if it was just like a few cases.
Well, there also is the instance that they have Han Chinese people going into Xinjiang and like staying with Uyghur families.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they're trained in, the Han Chinese people, is like, you know, they're supposed to keep their eye out to see if these people are potentially terrorists. Oh. So one of the things is like they like bring a bag of meat and make dumplings.
Okay.
And it's like, are they like very concerned about it being pork? Well, then they might be, you know, a terrorist.
They might have beliefs.
That's interesting you say, because my uncle and aunt actually just recently, they're from Shanghai. They actually went on one of these trips and, they did it through a photography club. And what they do is they go over there and they bring like clothing and like used, because they're like really poor, those the Uyghurs out there. Like,
oh, so they actually went to Xinjiang.
Yeah, so the whole thing is they have this photography club, and you know, like, dude, like, you know, Asians and their cameras, man, we love taking photos, and like for them it's like social cred to go out there and get like these awesome shots. You know, it's just like Instagram here in the States. Like, oh man, I went to Uyghur territory. Mm-hmm. And so they stay in these places, and like the people are lovely. Like, because I'm sure most Uyghurs are probably really lovely people, and they're just trying to get along.
Well, they also don't want to be reported to the central authorities as well.
Right, but no, the thing is, they actually really like this specific photo group, because they bring in like clothing and like books for their schools and stuff. I don't know if they're being talked to. Like, I'm not saying I don't believe you, but I'm just saying, like, yeah, it's interesting you say that, because like. Like the way I hear them talk about it, I was like, yeah, they're just like, it's not very Chinese there at all. You know, it's Central Asia. It's like completely different culture, completely different.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of crazy if you think about it.
Right. Know? Well, I mean, a lot of ways it's more like Kazakhstan or Tajikistan.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And like for a while, historically, like for some parts of history, that area was part of Chinese rule, like the late Qing dynasty. Part of it was sometimes part of Russian rule.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was kind of not really overseen by anybody except the local tribes and so on. So they've got all these influences there along the ancient Silk Road went right through Xinjiang.
Yeah.
And there's all these different
road goes through it today.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's interesting. So like back with like Saudi Arabia going to visit, like it's not a lot of the traditional Middle Eastern leaders are saying much about what's going on to the Uyghurs, right? Or even the Rohingyas in Burma.
You know,
there's more of a concentration, obviously, on like Israel and Palestine, it seems. And like when it comes to like,
I was just thinking about, you know, who stood up for the Muslims in Xinjiang and the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar?
Was it Turkish, right, or something?
No, it was actually Vice President Mike Pence.
Mike Pence, okay.
Mm-hmm. And like, you're just like, wait, what? But like for him, he's a deeply religious man.
Yeah, yeah.
So like for him, it's like if you're persecuted for your beliefs, it doesn't matter, because like he surely, as a man of Christian faith, surely doesn't believe that Islam is equally true to Christianity.
Sure.
But I get the sense that he believes that if you persecute people for their beliefs, then people then don't have a chance to find what the true belief is, which in his view would be belief in Jesus. And so, like, actually, what's interesting is that makes him very concerned about people of all faiths.
Sure.
And I think that's actually really admirable. It's just that you just don't expect this kind of thing to come from
Mike Pence,
or just the White House in general. It just seems unusual, because so few U.S. Administrations have allowed anyone in the administration to be quite as outspoken about human rights as the current administration. And even though Trump isn't talking about human rights, as far as I know, having the VP do it is very interesting. And it's quite groundbreaking.
It's probably a personal thing for him.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he seems like a devoutly religious man.
And meanwhile, China is like actively supporting terrorist groups in Pakistan.
Right. Well, giving them weapons, munitions. Right.
I forget the guy's name, but Matt, do you remember the name of the organization, like the Hashish something or another? You don't?
Hashish something? I'm not sure.
There's a guy in Pakistan that's generally seen as like the leader of a major terrorist organization there.
Is he part of the government, or is he an opposition?
I don't think so.
He isn't, okay.
But China has used its position in the UN to block that label.
Okay, but like China is deeply involved in the Pakistani military, so they're playing both sides here.
Yeah, but did you know that actually a lot of Islamic terrorists are actually deeply influenced by early communist writings?
No, I didn't know.
So it's actually
isn't that like kind of exactly the opposite you would think?
Like, well, you would think, right? Yeah, right? Because it's like, oh, atheism, communism, religion, Islam. But like a lot of the tactics, because if you consider like terrorist organizations, typically, you know, the vast majority of terrorists, more than 90% of the victims of terrorist attacks are other Muslims in Muslim countries.
Sure.
It's typically not going after, Americans, even though it seems very shocking to us when these incidents do happen. They're actually kind of rare, and most terrorist attacks in the U.S. are not actually Muslim terrorists.
Yeah.
But in Muslim countries, they're really concerned about Muslim terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them
just call it terrorism.
Or you know, extremist. And Q-Tip, I think if I'm saying the name right, was one of the early early 20th century Islamist thinkers who sort of started this, a lot of terrorist ideology. Who he read Marx, he read Lenin. He was kind of influenced by this idea of using class struggle to struggle against other Muslims who didn't share the beliefs.
Yeah, that Sunni-Shia split kind of too.
Right, and so it's basically taking... Because, like, yeah, it doesn't make sense, right, from an outsider who... Like, I haven't read the Quran. I'm not that familiar with the tenets of Islam. But to me, you know, you see, like, oh, well, Sunni-Shia, like, obviously they're different.
Right.
But why is it that they're literally... They feel they have to kill each other because these ideas of class struggle have been exacerbated. And that idea, like, think about the terrorist attacks against, against the U.S.
Yeah.
9/11. Let's just make the assumption that it is what the government says it is. Mm-hmm. That it was a Muslim terrorist attack. But like, what did it achieve? It didn't make the world better for Muslims. It didn't make the world better for Americans. It didn't make it better for anyone. All it did was exacerbated hatred and conflict.
Sure.
And this is a tactic that you see used again and again in Soviet Union, in China, where you get groups to fight each other, but it's not over something productive like, you know, I want your land or your cows or even political power. Mm-hmm. It's just struggle because that allows... When you get other groups struggling, then you create opportunities for yourself to gain more power and resources.
Well, I actually think, I got to do a little more reading about what you're saying, but I do think that there was a clear goal behind 9/11, and it was really to just weigh down America, right? Like, I mean, look how large our security apparatus has grown. I mean, look at how big our deficit has grown. You know, we've got, $3 trillion in just the last... 2 years, right?
Yeah, well, you know that book Unrestricted Warfare by those two Chinese generals that came out in the 90s? Like, they had some suggestion in there about, like, you know, if there were, like, an attack on New York, like, it would it would have this kind of effect. And I'm not saying that, like, China was behind 9/11.
Sure.
But at the time in China, there was a lot of delight at what happened. And this kind of like feeling of America got what it deserved. And there's even like a state-run Beijing news documentary called Attack America that basically said something like, you know, this is the America we've all wanted to see. Blood debts have been repaid in blood.
Mm-hmm.
And this like very anti-American sentiment that was echoed by a lot of people in China.
Okay.
Because of the propaganda, just like this idea, like you know, this enemy gets attacked and you feel like, like, that's good. Even though, like, these are civilians that were killed in 9/11. These aren't enemy combatants by any definition.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of people definitely hate America. And you're right. Like, I think who really won from the war in the Middle East, it was China.
China.
Because China had unrestricted growth during that whole entire period where we were just running.
And right before 9/11, like, the U.S. government was beginning to have a shift in focus towards the Asia Pacific, particularly China. And that completely got derailed and didn't even go back to looking at China till towards the end of the Obama administration.
Trillions of dollars and like 15 years later.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think there's. I just want to say I don't think there's a connection though between China or you know.
Like, is China behind 9/11? Yeah, like, I kind of doubt that. I don't think there's any evidence to support that. But
no, but going back to like you're saying that a lot of the modern, I guess, fundamentalism. You're saying the modern fundamentalist movement, like the new muftis, you know, in Saudi Arabia.
Like, you know, like ISIS, Al Qaeda. Like, they're influenced by some of this communist thought.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually look, like, if you look at the Muslim Brotherhood, right? I mean, this is kind of the one of the root organizations that helped inspire Hamas and Al Qaeda. I mean, they really focus a lot on social programming, like kind of helping the community out. You know, like the mosque, just like, you know, other religious institutions gave out food, gave out medical care, education. So there is that kind of, I guess you can connect that with communism in some way, right? Like it's providing services for people, you know?
I don't know if I would describe that as what communism is about. That's something they say they do, but in reality, if you look at the Soviet Union or China, it's more about tactics to amass power.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I mean, there is one case where I think I think any kind of government system can work in small scale. Like if you have it, you know, to a so one example would be like the kibbutzes in Israel, right? Like, I mean, these were actually as close as pure communism as you could get in, you know, real practical life, because we've never had actual communism, right, in play. Just impossible. But like these kibbutzes in the early days of Israel were basically everyone shared everything. You know, like all the kids were put into like nursery schools together. You know, everyone basically worked the fields together. They didn't own anything. But what you naturally saw as Israel became more developed, the security issues less, less of an issue, a lot of these kibbutzes transitioned to more of like private ownership and everything like that. But for a while, it actually kind of worked in that one specific circumstance. So I find interesting, you know, like...
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I do know a guy who like grew up in a kibbutz,
yeah.
And like
no,
he doesn't
mixed.
Speak highly of it.
No, some
yeah,
people, some
I've
people
definitely
hate
heard like very mixed reviews. Like, definitely, there's people who loved it.
Yeah.
And I think typically the smaller ones were better, from what I've heard from some of my Israeli friends. But
well, what made a kibbutz successful usually is that they had some kind of industrial capability, some kind of product that they could actually sell to the outside world. You know, like just, I mean, at the end of the day, they still needed to generate, you know, enough money that they could share collectively. Now, I'm not supporting communism. I'm just saying, like, you know, this is one case where, you know, at least on a small scale.
Right. Well, but it's also a little different than, like, if you look at communism from the perspective of Marx and Engels, which is the forcible overthrow of the existing class structure through violent revolution. And that's what when people like Vladimir Lenin were in his October Revolution for the Soviet Union, that was like communism in the sort of purest Marxist sense is a violent, forcible overthrow of the existing ruling class. And so what you had in a kibbutz is a community that's working together by choice.
Right.
Not they killed the landlords and took their stuff.
Sure, sure.
So I don't know if I would even call it, like, it's, yeah, there's some elements you could say are the sharing part of it, but it's a voluntary program.
Sure, definitely.
And it's people coming together to share stuff on a very small scale and not killing the rich people.
Yeah, I mean, there is a difference between, like, the very traditional form of communalism that, like, small tribes and small villages would always engage in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when it's a nation state kind of level.
Well, it's that idea of redistribution of wealth, right? Like, I mean, I think a lot of conservatives find it immoral to literally just take money away from people, right? Like, it is money that we have earned, we've worked hard for. And I kind of like, now that we're kind of in this area, I want to go back to this whole UBI thing, because I'm kind of curious to hear what you guys think about it, because I haven't really made my own mind about it. You know, back to this Andrew Yang guy who's running for president. It's just like I heard him talk a lot about, first of all, what I really liked about this guy was he wasn't very emotional. He wasn't very political. I mean, he was just coming with figures and numbers, you know, and he was explaining to us, like, you know, like in 10 years, most major think tanks are quoting somewhere around 20-30% job loss, you know. So, like, these are very scary numbers for the United States. And, like, his idea, of course, is we need to somehow make sure that these people who are going to lose their jobs and stay basically unemployed, they have a way to take care of themselves. Because, you know, like, once unemployment reaches kind of a large number, you're going to just have instability in society, right? I mean, it's a pretty big issue, you know.
Yeah. Well, UBI doesn't solve the employment issue, but it does provide a certain sort of minimal safety net.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, hypothetically.
Well, I think that when the program begins, it basically would do that. Although, actually, the amount he proposed was $1,000 a month is very low.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. Most people, I think, when you hear UBI, you think, oh, this is a job replacement program. But the way he seems to say it,
it's a small supplement.
Right, exactly.
But here's the thing. I think that the point he makes, which I think is a is a good point, is that it would be a replacement for other entitlement programs, mm-hmm. such as Social Security,
right.
and welfare and food stamps.
So the
and
idea is that you give the person the same equivalent of money that they have to decide.
I don't think he specifically said he's going to defund Social Security.
No, he said people were going to get the option to take either the UBI or what they're currently getting.
Right.
So here's, I think, the merit behind that argument, which is one of the problems with welfare and food stamps, not Social Security, but welfare mm-hmm. and food stamps, is that if you work, then your benefits decrease. So mm-hmm. you're de-incentivized to work, or you're incentivized to work at jobs that are under the table cash.
Sure.
For example, including selling drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that perspective, if everyone who's currently getting welfare and food stamps, suddenly it was an unconditional amount of money, more of those people would be incentivized to work. And on top of that, you eliminate a lot of the bureaucracy. So you actually save money doing it that way. And I think that's why, just from the perspective of replacing those current programs with a simple UBI, universal basic income, it's actually more efficient
yeah.
and more fair and encourages people to work more. That doesn't mean that it's actually an overall good idea.
Yeah, no, the UBI part is really the part of his campaign where I just don't really understand enough, you know? But I think the issues that he's talking about, like, generally are important, and we don't hear a lot of politicians talk about. Like, for instance, the job unemployment rate, right? It's somewhere at, what, like 4%, 4.9%, and, like, you know, if you launch all the business news channels, they're all like, wow, you know, everyone was wrong. You know, the American economy is doing really well. But if you could look at, like, actual like Americans engaging in the job market, it is quite low. I don't know what the stats are specifically, but I think it was somewhere in the 60% range. So somewhere.
No, that was right? his statistic, but I don't think that's actually the employment, which you normally, I forget what
well,
it is.
Well, no, engagement in the actual, like, a lot of people have just basically given up. And, like, I mean, just from anecdotal evidence, I guess, was not really there, but I do notice that a lot of my friends have kind of just given up. There are a lot of people just living at home now.
I remember that was actually something Trump spoke about on the campaign trail.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the reasons why, like, people say, oh, Trump won because people are racist and voting for him, but, like, I think that he targeted a demographic in America that was just clearly underrepresented. I mean, you know, we all live in the city, right? But if you've ever gone to, like, the middle of the country, I mean, you know, you got a lot of these secondary, tertiary cities are just falling apart, you know, like, and on top of that, you have the opioid epidemic and all these other different things. I mean, like, it's not good, right?
Right.
One of the stats I think he said that was really interesting was that, I think from 2005 to 2015, 95% of jobs created were, non-traditional, as in gig jobs, part-time jobs, as in jobs that don't have really benefits, you know, no security then, as you're saying, you know, and we've noticed that, like, since the recession, right, we're seeing our GDP increase more and more, but at the end of this year, we saw major companies like Activision post, like, major, like, best sales numbers in, you know, their history, but at the same time, they'll lay off 800 people. So I think, like, corporate consolidation is really what's driving a lot of our economic growth, whereas, you know, if you actually look at the job market, which you have are a lot of high-end jobs that might not necessarily have the proper candidates, and then you have a lot of people who are also unemployed because their skills no longer fit the existing market we're in, right?
Yeah, well, I think, though, that economically speaking, just in my opinion,
yeah.
the best way to deal with the unemployment is to figure out measures to stimulate small business.
Okay.
Because roughly 2/3 of all people in the U.S. are employed in small businesses. And even though we think about these, you know, the Amazons and so on, and the Googles and so on, being these giant corporations, and it's true, they are. And they do provide a lot of jobs, and some of them are good jobs, and some of them are not that good of jobs. But it's actually small businesses that are the driving factor. And I think that, you know, ever since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, 150 plus years ago, there's been a concern that, oh, well, these machines will replace our jobs.
Sure.
And it's true that machines do replace jobs. But what happens is that inevitably as long as you're in a market economy where people are incentivized to innovate,
right,
then new jobs are created. And if you have a competitive market that's encourages competition and encourages innovation, then you will have a greater number of new jobs that we haven't even imagined. Like app sure. developers was not a job that was available 20 years ago.
Well, let's talk about, for instance, higher education, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so tuition costs have gone crazy. I know, Chris, like, you know, you've talked to me about this a lot of the times, and I know a lot of people who have, like, you know, huge student loans. And like, how has college tuition increased so much in the last, like, decade, right? Two decades.
Administrators.
So like, you're creating jobs, but are these jobs actually necessary, or are we just creating jobs for the sake of it? And like,
well,
and
no, but the reason universities have more administrative jobs is because universities have more students with more money.
Right.
And part of that is international students, but a big part of it is also students can now get student loans so easily
right.
that more people are going to college. And so the budgets go up for the universities, and so they can hire more people. And so they have more administrators, and so the costs go up.
But I remember like going to college, and I remember the portals I used, the internet services that they had. I mean, it was terrible. Like, you know, like you don't think we can streamline a lot of these colleges by cutting down their administration staff and basically automating a lot of these jobs, and then we'll have cheaper tuition? Because
But how do you propose that happens? Like, well, someone just tells colleges to do it and they do it? Like, there has to be a market incentive for them to do it.
Exactly, a market incentive. And right now, I mean, what if we take away grants? What if we say, like, we're not going to give you guys, you know, all these scholarships. We're not going to fund these ridiculous tuition amounts. I mean, we're talking about like $40,000 a year for a liberal arts degree. I mean, that's crazy, dude. Like, come on.
But also, not everyone necessarily needs that degree. Like, I think,
what do we tell our kids now? What do people, I come from, you know, the Northeast, and I know in my town, I remember people, like, if you didn't go to college, people look down on you. You know, it's a toxic environment, but that's just what it is in America right now.
Well, I don't know. I mean, my dad, who's like a Yale Law School graduate.
Sure.
He said to me when I was 17, he said, if you don't want to go to college, mm-hmm. you don't have to go. And you'll figure it out.
Your dad was a smart man.
And I won't pressure you to go. And I ended up taking a year off before going to college just to make sure it was something I really wanted to do.
Also very smart.
Yeah, but like, I think my dad also was very much in favor of trade schools. Mm-hmm. Because I would even put computer programming as a trade school category. Because I think that people who want to take certain types of jobs working in industries that are largely automated, like auto manufacturing is largely automated.
Sure.
You need to be very computer literate. You need to know computer programming, but you're not a full-on coder necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like a one-year or two-year trade school, just like they have for plumbing.
Sure.
You could be very competent. You could be trained to get the new types of jobs that come out.
Yeah.
And by treating it as a trade school, it's going to be more efficient. You're not going to waste your money on other types of courses and stuff that really aren't going to be that useful for you.
Yeah, it's funny to talk about coding. There's this whole learn to code controversy thing going on, right? Like, you guys know about this? Like, some guys on Twitter got banned for this when...
Yeah, after BuzzFeed laid off a bunch of people.
Yeah, that's messed up. And hey, like, you can hate someone, but you shouldn't make fun of them for losing their jobs.
Well, there was this... it was... that there was a sense that... you know, since there is a lot of unemployment problems in the country, there was a sort of response of people who were in dire straits, of people just being like, oh, well, learn to code.
Right.
Like, that's what you should do, obviously. And, like, that's not always an option for people. But so that caused a lot of resentment. And then when all these, like, BuzzFeed writers and I think Vice 2 got laid off, a bunch of these people were like, oh, I guess it's time to learn to code.
Right. I mean, I disagree with that sentiment. I don't think you should make fun of people for losing their jobs because it's just mean. But, like, they are kind of right. Like, a lot of these job retrainment programs, you know, like, one of the big industries that's going to basically disappear in the next 10 years is trucking, right? So, like, this is a really, really terrible job that kind of is very hard on the body. You know, you're basically sitting down your entire time. A lot of these guys have to take stimulants to stay awake. You know, they're driving like 14 hours a day. And they're trying to retrain these truckers to code, and like these programs are failing. Like massive amounts of people are just not making it.
Well, it's
coders,
also kind of a backwards looking thing. Like you went to school for
right. These guys are middle aged. They're not in the. Yeah. They don't have. You know.
Well, what I'm saying is like you went to school to learn like camera editing, all these things, and like how many years after you graduated was all of that technology outdated?
It was outdated when I was in school.
There you go.
Yeah.
So this is the problem with like dealing with a problem like by looking at the past.
But what do you do with these people? Because these are, you know, good, honest people, and you know, they're gonna lose their jobs really quickly. And
yeah.
You're talking about Amazon before, like, you know, Amazon never makes any money, right? They're always reinvesting their revenue. Like these kind of like Amazon is like, you know, we're here in New York right now, and New York just steered Amazon away from building a giant headquarter in Long Island City. I mean, that to me, I'm not just seeing a potential headquarter. I'm seeing like a capital for a corporation that will be as powerful as a country, you know, in like a few decades, right? I mean, these are companies that are just they're terrific at what they do. They're destroying the competition, right? I mean, they're moving in on all sorts of retail. They're moving on in on like food services, right? Healthcare industry, everything. Mm. So, you know, like if we don't somehow figure out a way to get some tax revenue from Amazon, because that's where all the automation money is going to go to, right? I mean, they're going to basically make a lot of money with this technology. It's kind of like the next economic boom, right? AI and all this kind of stuff. You know, so how do we get this money back? This is why the full circle, going back to the UBI idea.
I talked about why I think there's some merit to UBI, but I think that it proposes a number of real problems.
Okay.
So for one is one of the main ways of funding it is a 10% VAT tax or value added tax like they have in Europe.
Okay.
Which is like it's basically a tax on spending. So everything you spend, that 10% goes to the tax. The problem with this is that because, you know, economically speaking, price increases are passed on to the consumers, right? So the value of your money goes down by 10% because prices will go up by 10%.
Won't prices also go down because of automation? Won't things get cheaper?
Well, yes, but that's a separate issue.
Yeah.
Like, so the issue of if you have a 10% VAT tax to pay for UBI, then your $1,000 a month is really only worth $900 in today's money.
Sure.
Because everything's going to be more expensive.
Right.
And now, still $900, it seems like, okay, that's great. I'd love to have it every month. But consider this. The average individual American adult earns roughly $4,000 a month. And assuming the average American or the median American is also spending that money every month, that money's also not going to go as far. It doesn't buy $4,000 worth of stuff anymore because now you have the VAT. So now it's only, you know, $3,600. So they lose $400 of their $4,000 regular income, plus they lose $100 from the UBI $1,000.
Right.
So basically, there's now UBI, everyone gets $1,000, but the median household is actually losing $500 a month because of the VAT tax.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and for anyone who's making $120,000 a year or more, it's an absolute loss for them, even if they're getting the $1,000 from UBI.
Sure.
So economically speaking, it's not nearly as big of a benefit. And the people who are spending money, who live paycheck to paycheck, they've got jobs. That's the people for whom this 10% additional VAT tax is going to hurt the most, because they're spending their money and they've now lost 10% of the value of all of their money, including all of their savings, because now they can't buy as much stuff with their money. So I think that's the problem with adding a very significant new tax. It's not a tax on billionaires. It's a tax on the people who spend most of their income, which is the poor and the middle class. And it sounds great to give everyone $1,000 a month, but the economics of that are not super. They're not as much.
Right.
And I'm not saying it's nothing. But here's the other issue with that, which is now you've created a country where everyone is relying on this $1,000 a month. And so employers realize that they don't have to pay as much because some workers will be willing to take a job that earns a little less because they know they now have this UBI.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will over time distort the job market and result in lower wages. And you can say, well, minimum wage will take care of that. And minimum wage kind of does, to the extent that the people who get those jobs now have more money every hour they work. But as we've seen with increases in minimum wage, employers, especially small businesses, they don't hire quite as many people. So it doesn't help employment. In fact, it goes the opposite direction from the employment that we want to have.
Yeah, I think that's also the biggest problem is, you know, even if you're giving people money, without a job, what are people going to do? You know, if you're that truck driver and you lose your job, what are you going to do? You're just going to sit around home. Sure, you get your, UBI check, right, $1,000. And maybe if you're living in the middle of the country, that might be barely enough. No, if you're in the middle of the country, we're thinking about New York City prices, but, like, what is the poverty line in per capita, right? Somewhere around, like, $15,000, right,
yeah,
per individual.
So you're still going to be living in poverty,
right,
at $1,000.
But then you can, we're talking about that 95% growth in, gig jobs and, driving Uber and stuff. Maybe you can supplement yourself in one way, but the problem really is, right, we still don't have job creation.
Right, so UBI does nothing to create new jobs. It redistributes wealth, but it's actually, what's weird about it is you're redistributing. When you do VAT tax, you're redistributing the wealth from the poor and middle class mostly,
sure,
and not from the billionaires that people say they want to tax.
Right. 80% of Americans are living right now paycheck to paycheck, right? I mean, they're spending everything they have. So,
their money's going to be worth less.
Well, the one thing
that's why it's very.
But that money will directly come back into the system. That is one of the good parts. But I think, what about, like, the biggest problem is, like, he's saying only a VAT tax, right? So you're right. We're not targeting Amazon so much with the VAT tax. We're not targeting companies like, those trucking industries that will automate their entire staff, within the next 10 years. So, what then, like, corporate gains tax? Are we talking about, how are you actually going to redistribute some of this new gained resources automation?
There's a larger question. Is it the federal government's job to be in the business of redistributing wealth? And if so, how much? Because here's the when you take it to an extreme, obviously you get communism.
Yeah.
When you take it halfway there, you have a very deeply socialist state. But here's what I would ask is, should it be the government's job to do that? Because what happens is, when you have everyone relying on it,
sure,
then the government can never, ever go back and take it away.
100%. Because I agree with you 100%.
80% of people who are going to feel like they benefit from it will never elect a politician ever again who says they're going to take away that UBI that you're getting.
But what's really the trend in America in the last 20 years? And I think it's deregulation. And almost from, Clinton and, 93 Communication Act,
repeal of Glass-Steagall.
Right, like all these things. I mean, a lot of the media, we have 5-6 media companies that basically run everything. Mm-hmm. We have deregulation of the airline industry, deregulation of utilities. Everything's getting deregulated. And, I'm not anti-government, but my perception of government is not very good. I typically, I look at their response to technology is really, really slow. I mean, they just don't understand innovation or technology at all. They're trying to understand how to rein in all these social media problems they're having right now. And, my biggest worry is that government is there to trust break up monopolies. And I don't think they're really capable of doing that job anymore.
Well, the DOJ has done almost nothing in antitrust or monopoly breaking up.
Look, now you have, state attorneys basically receiving money from the industries that they're supposed to be being watchdogs. I mean, so, like, our entire democratic system has been infiltrated at, the highest level.
Well, it does tend to get stagnant when you have, these institutions, and they... You end up with, a lot of corporate funding of political campaigns.
Which is why Trump won, I think. A lot of people want to come in and go, bam, right?
Well, I mean, I think people assume that Obama would break up some of the banks after the Great Recession, but instead he kind of put bankers in charge of, the Fed and the regulators, and they didn't, you know, none of the CEOs went to jail.
I mean, why didn't we just let everything break, you know?
Well,
I mean, that's not politically expedient, but
I mean, there's an answer to that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's an answer to why we didn't let things break, because it probably would have been worse. But the answer isn't let everything fall apart on its own or do what we did, because there's another answer, which is you do a sort of semi bailout, but conditional.
Right.
The condition could be
there was
that the CEOs go to jail.
Right.
Maybe
limit their bonuses. To a certain degree.
Limit bonuses.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
You could have a different regulatory environment that ensures it doesn't happen again. Put Glass-Steagall back into place where they don't mix commercial and private banking funds. And so, like, there's a lot of things that could have been done, and they just weren't done to protect from it happening again.
Yeah.
And
I mean, look at federal interest rates right now. Right. Well, we've been at like what, 1 or 2% for like a decade.
Yeah, I mean, they're going back up slowly.
I mean, they should be going up quicker, I think, right? I mean, it's insanity, right? Like, how much of our economic growth is actually financial engineering? How much of it is actual real growth?
Because that's what happens when you have super low interest rates. It stimulates growth, but not all of it's the kind of investments that people would make if there were a bit more money at stake.
I mean, we're seeing a lot of protectionism right now. Right. And whereas what's the real thing that's happening? We're protecting ourselves from what? The future, right? Like, you know, at the end of the day, those coal jobs that we're trying to protect, those manufacturing jobs, I mean, I know it's not nice to say this, but they're going to be gone.
It is very hard to get the coal jobs back.
I mean, no, there's just no need for coal China probably has their own pipeline. Like, I don't think it's really...
A coal pipeline?
Coal pipeline.
Under the Atlantic.
Right, exactly. It would be a conveyor belt. But... Yeah, no, I mean, I look at all these things, and I feel like there's something off, you know?
About the world today?
I watch a lot of business news, and I feel like a lot of the anchors I see are just trying to put on a cheerful face. Like, oh, man, things are doing great, guys. You know, we should go out there and, you know, our GDP is increasing. You know, Americans are doing better than ever, and I feel like a lot of the things we see in the media, you know, a lot of the culture clash. So a lot of these racial issues, I do think they directly stem from economic issues, I think, you know.
Which is why we need to put humanity first.
We need to put humanity first. We need to get an alien invasion now so that we start fighting each other and then we start concentrating on fighting the aliens.
We stop fighting each other and start fighting the aliens.
Yes, unless they're already amongst us.
Like, well, but what Mark happened Zuckerberg. In Three Body Problem? When the
they came out
you'll
the
have
movie,
to read
you know?
The book. No, that's actually not Three Body
it's not,
Problem.
It's not
Three Body
Problem. Okay.
If you want to know what happened to Three Body Problem, you should read it yourself.
Maybe I don't want to spoil it, but I'm not sure that what you think would happen because science fiction tells us what the real future is going to be like.
No, yeah.
That's sometimes true. So, read the Three Body Problem. And on that note, Alan, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And one more time, what's the names of your channels?
Oh, so it's Generation Tech. And Generation Films.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Matt Gnezda.
And Shelley will be back soon, we promise. Thanks for listening.